Are in 1 Kings chapter 21. Last week we finished up chapter 20. There were a couple of wars that went on with the nation to the north, Syria. Syria had become a problem for Israel several years before what we were dealing with here, and at one point the king of Syria had come down and attacked Israel and taken away the northern part of Israel that we refer to as Galilee. This area surrounding the Sea of Galilee had been taken away by the Syrians. That was after David's rule. And when we come to Ahab's rule, then Syria came down with two incursions into Israelite territory that we read about in chapter 20. The first incursion ended with a siege of the capital city of northern Israel, which is Samaria, down here on our map right there. God intervened in a miraculous way, and the Syrian army, which was much greater than the Israelite army, was defeated. And Syria was forced to retreat. And they came back the next year and said, well, let's go ahead and try a little bit of a different battle tactic. Since the God of Israel is a God of the hills, let's try to defeat him in the valleys. And so they mounted an offensive against Israel in the valley of Jezreel, thinking that, well, God must be limited in his power. So God told King Ahab, since they're thinking this way, I'm going to prove them wrong. And Israel again defeated a much larger Syrian force. And the king of Syria surrendered to Ahab, the king of Israel, and Ahab welcomed him as a brother. This is how we closed out our time last week. A prophet of the Lord came to Ahab with that brilliant illustration of pretending to be a soldier who had lost prisoners of war that he was guarding. And the punishment that would be exacted from him would be the death penalty for losing your prisoners of war. And as soon as Ahab said, yes, that's a just punishment, the prophet took off his disguise and said, actually, that judgment goes against you because God delivered the king of Syria into your hand in order to use you as an instrument of punishment on Syria, but you didn't do that. You let him go. And so, since you have done that, the end of the chapter was that the Lord says to Ahab, because you've let go out of your hand the man whom I have devoted to destruction, therefore your life shall be for his life and your people for his people. So this judgment not only against Ahab, but also against the nation of Israel. God is now going to discipline and chastise Israel for letting the Syrians go. And what was Ahab's response to that prophecy? The next verse, what is it? Oh, I'm sorry, we're at the end of chapter 20 there, verse 43. Sullen and vexed. Don't you love that wording? Yep. Anybody ever been sullen and vexed? Yeah, we all get that way. Heavy and displeased. Any other translations there? We're in verse 43 of chapter 20. 1 Kings chapter 20, verse 43. The ESV reads, sullen and vexed. And Patricia, you're reading out of the Evidence Bible. What version is that? Might be a
King James.
It's a King James, okay. And it says what?
Pardon?
What does it say in verse 29 or verse
43?
Yes, heavy and displeased, right. The idea there is exactly what you're thinking of, somebody that cannot be made happy because they didn't get what they want. We run into these people occasionally, don't you? People that, if it were a little child, we'd call it a temper tantrum, or we'd call it pouting. You know what the trouble is with letting children pout? They become adults that pout. And the pouting of an adult is much more serious than the pouting of a child. When a child is allowed to pout, Oh, they might kick and stomp or throw themselves on the floor, and potentially they're going to hurt themselves doing that. But if you don't teach children how to control their responses by disciplining them appropriately with things like that, they become adults that pout. Ahab has grown up to be a man who pouts, and it is not as harmless as the tantrum of a 2 or 3 year old, it is much, much more serious. He goes home sullen and vexed. The idea there is completely distraught and implacable. He cannot be made happy because he didn't get what he wants. And I want you to remember that wording, vexed and sullen, because we're going to run into it again here in this next chapter. What's that? Nope, just vexed. Yep, vexed, disturbed. So we come to chapter 21. And the war scenes, the battle scenes, have faded off of the picture, and we're now back in Jezreel. The timing here is at some point after the Syrian war. We don't know how long. Actually, if you jump ahead real quick to chapter 22, verse 1, we can get a little bit of chronological information. Chapter 22, verse 1 says, "For 3 years, Syria and Israel continued without war. But in the third year, dot, dot, dot," and we go through the rest of the chapter. So, the timing here is that between the Syrian war that we just read in chapter 20 and chapter 22, there are 3 years of peace. Remember, the Syrian war ended with Ben-Hadad surrendering to Ahab and promising trade relationships. He says he restored the cities of Israel that were taken earlier, and he gave Ahab permission to set up a trade relationship with Damascus, with the capital of Syria. And so that goes on for 3 years, but then the peace is broken in chapter 22, and we're going to find out, spoiler alert, if you don't want to know how this story ends, you can just cover your ears up. Spoiler alert, in chapter 22, Ahab dies. So we are, at this point in chapter 21, we are somewhere between 3 and 0 years towards the end of Ahab's life. Ahab sat on the throne for 22 years. So we're somewhere in the final 3 years of that dynasty, or that reign, not dynasty. This is Israel. This is the northern chapter, yeah. The writer of 1 Kings paused everything with Judah for quite a while in order to focus on Elijah and Ahab, because this 22-year reign of Ahab was an extremely important turning point in the history of Israel. It was the opportunity for the northern kingdom to either return to the Lord or to continue to walk away from him. And if you know anything about Ahab at all, which direction do they go? They go away from him, right? And so this is sort of the beginning of the end of the northern kingdom. From here on out, it's going to be a quick march downhill to the destruction of the northern kingdom by the Assyrians. But we have another 150 or so years, maybe 200 years before that actually happens. And so it's going to continue on for quite a while. But towards the end of Ahab's reign, verse 21, "Now Naboth the Jezreelite had a vineyard in Jezreel." Did I say verse 21? Okay, sorry. Chapter 21, verse 1. "Now Naboth the Jezreelite had a vineyard in Jezreel beside the palace of Ahab, king of Samaria." So here's the setup. The capital of the northern kingdom has been established in this city, Samaria, named after Shemer, the man who owned the region originally. Samaria, in Hebrew, there's a little period. There's one little dot difference between a s sound and a sh sound. They're very, very close. If you remember from your reading in the book of Judges, at one point there's a civil war in Israel, and the Israelites were crossing the Jordan River, and they began stopping people and asking them to pronounce the word Shibboleth. And the people on the eastern side could only say Sibboleth, and the people on the western side would say Shibboleth. Because of the similarity in sounds, it was like an accent difference, but if you said Shibboleth, or I forget which way exactly it went, but if you said the wrong one, they killed you on the spot. So how's that for profiling, right? If you can't pronounce your SHs, you're dead meat. Well, at any rate, Samaria from Shemer, is the capital of the northern kingdom here. However, the king of Israel maintains probably a summer home here in Jezreel. True to form, with most governments that have grown completely out of control, the ruler has many, many houses and servants, even though God commanded them not to do so. And so he has this palace in Jezreel, and so we hear about a fellow named Naboth, who owns a vineyard near the royal palace in Jezreel. So, it's a vineyard. So let's talk about location. Where would a vineyard probably be located? What's that? Maybe near a river. There are many streams and things there in the valley of Jezreel. But inside the town or just outside the town? It's probably just outside the town if you're going to have a vineyard. You're going to be either right outside the city or, you know, out in the fields. It's very possible that it's right next to the city because it is very close by to what other structure? Ahab's palace. So here's Ahab's palace, and it looks out over the city walls, and there is Naboth's vineyard, this beautiful place with nice grapes growing all over the place, and I'm sure that he's making delicious jams and jellies all the time, and it's just a beautiful looking spot. And so, verse 2, after this, Ahab said to Naboth, "Give me your vineyard that I may have it for a vegetable garden, because it is near my house, and I will give you a better vineyard for it. Or if it seems good to you, I will give you its value in money." What is Ahab doing?
Trying to buy it?
Or trade. Getting a burial ground? No, he wants to, it says make a vegetable garden. He wants to make, vegetable garden is a good concept there. It's a farm, but it's something that, you know, you wouldn't grow your cash crop in this thing. You're going to grow your day-to-day needs in it. So he's not looking for a field to grow a cash crop like wheat or barley. He's looking to grow things that he's going to use in his salads and on his dinner table. Dan, we talked about this in Sunday school a little bit this morning. Does that statement that Ahab makes sound familiar? Eminent domain. Eminent domain. Give me your vineyard and I'll give you something better. Or I'll take it and give you money. Yeah. How often, when something better is promised, does it actually turn out to be better? I love what you told us this morning. Great story. Tell us again. Doesn't stop it. There's always garbage blowing across that road up there. Yeah. It's crazy. And it smells so lovely, too.
Well, actually, when you're going to 251, you know, there's landfill on both sides.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter which way the wind's.
That's right. You imagine how hard it is to hang your laundry out up there. Yeah. Yeah, whoo. You might as well just get a dryer. You're not going to hang your clothes out up there. Yeah, hang it inside.
You know, first off, they couldn't get the house.
Yeah.
Their house was really bad and run down. But it didn't turn out.
Deuteronomy chapter 17 gives some of the instructions from God to Israel when they decide to put a king on the throne. It's an interesting read sometime, especially as we're comparing the Israelite kings and their practices. Read through that sometime and see what you think about what God says about the kings. They're not supposed to be multiplying wives. They're not supposed to be multiplying lands and houses. They're not supposed to be, you know, for instance, taking land from their subjects. And in fact, Naboth's response to this request is going to be interesting. So let's read this next verse here in verse 3. What does Naboth say in response to Ahab? The Lord forbid that I should give you my inheritance. What's the concept going on there? I mean, very first of all, whose name does Naboth invoke? The Lord. What does that tell you about Naboth? He's probably a faithful guy. Isn't that an interesting thing to find in Israel these days? Because what was Elijah concerned about? Yeah, there's nobody left. I alone serve the Lord. And God says, no, you don't. I have 7,000 people that haven't bowed the knee to Baal. Perhaps Naboth was one of them. So here is Naboth standing up against the king of Israel and saying, no, I'm not giving you my property. I will not sign that over. Why not? What's the reasoning he gives? Yeah, I won't give you my inheritance. Why was the inheritance so important? It's a piece of land. It's valuable, right? Maybe Ahab wasn't offering enough money. He's passing it on to his son. And where did he get it? From his father. And where did his father get it? Yeah, from his father. And keep going back here. How many generations? We're not sure. But you're going to go back about 550 years. And you're going to run into Joshua's generation. When Joshua leads the people of Israel into the land, and God himself tells them, here's your boundaries, now divide it up by lot, and you're going to give each tribe their inheritance. And then each tribe is going to divide up their land by lot and give to each of the families. And each family is going to divide up their section by lot and distribute it to the individuals. And these land inheritances go all the way back to Joshua, when God gave Israel the land. Land, very important concept as part of the inheritance. Who gives you the land? God does. Because who owns the land? God does. God is seen throughout the Old Testament as the king over all the other kings. Of course, that's a concept very important when you get to the New Testament, Revelation especially. But God is the king over all the other kings. He owns everything. And so when he grants you something, that's important, that's special. And Naboth recognizes that. God granted my family the land. I will not give it up. It was even built into Moses' law that if you were in hard times or ready to retire, or you just needed the money, you could sell the crop rights to somebody else, but you could not sell the land in perpetuity. Land could not be transferred from one family to another, right? That's how important the land grant was to the people of Israel under the Mosaic law. Now, we know that that's what Moses' law said, but how well did Israel obey Moses' law? They didn't do it very well. That's why he kicked them out of the land. But that concept of land was very important to the people who were faithful. And so Naboth is apparently a very faithful guy because he recognizes, no. Nobody else gets this land. That's my family's land. And if for some reason I can't leave it to my son, it goes to the next of kin so that it stays in the family. Now, he could have offered and said, well, now, Ahab, if you would like the use of the land, I will sell you the crop rights until the year of Jubilee. And this was the standing order from God. Every 50th year was a year of Jubilee. And in that year, all debts were canceled and everybody was restored back to their inheritance. So if you wanted to sell a piece of property, as long as it was a field, if it was a house inside a walled city, you could sell that in perpetuity. But if it was a field outside of the walled city, you could not sell the land outright. What you would do is sell the crop rights to that land until the year of Jubilee. So if you have 48 years left until the next Jubilee, you would obviously get more money for that land because that represents more years of crop income. If you only had 5 years until the next Jubilee, you'd get much less money because you're only buying 5 years of crop rights and not 48. And that was the system that God established because on the 50th year, everything returns to the inheritance It returns to the original owner. This is a beautiful picture of forgiveness, isn't it? God built into his system this picture of forgiveness so that Israel would learn how to forgive. Incidentally, don't you love those lawyer commercials about bankruptcy? Declare bankruptcy and you will have no more debt. You'll get all the creditors to stop calling you. On the one hand, it's really aggravating that they are tweaking the system and abusing the system to get out of paying their debt. You should pay your debts. God's very clear about that. On the other hand, bankruptcy is a biblical concept of saying if somebody is so destitute that they cannot meet their bills, then it is right and good to go ahead and forgive the debt. It does come with some problems, doesn't it? You know, Jubilee restored all or canceled all debts. So we have this, we have some of those concepts built in there. And yet at the same time, I'm off track. So let's go back to Naboth, right? Faithful guy, doesn't want to hand over his inheritance to Ahab, probably especially because it's Ahab. You know, would you really want to sell your land inheritance to this guy? Even to rent it out for the next 15 years or whatever it would be to the Jubilee, would you really want to sell it to him? Ahab has not been the most forthcoming, faithful of men. He hasn't shown himself to be a good, upstanding believer. And so Naboth's response is, "The Lord forbid that I should give you the inheritance of my fathers." And Ahab went into his house, what? Sullen and vexed, the exact same wording that we saw in the end of the last chapter. He has the same response to being denied this piece of property as he does to being told, "Your dynasty's done. I'm going to destroy you and your house in Israel." How would you compare those? If God came to you and said, "You know what, you've blown it so badly, I'm going to discipline you and your house and the entire country you live in." Hopefully we would have a response to that that would be something like, "Aha, that's not good," right? Ahab doesn't. He has the same response as when he's told no, he can't have something he really wants. Those should be different, shouldn't they? One of them should be genuine repentance. The other one should be self-control. But he has the same response to both of them. So he goes to his house vexed and sullen, and notice how this temper tantrum plays out here. He went vexed and sullen because of what Naboth the Jezreelite had said to him, for he had said, "I will not give you the inheritance of my fathers." And he lay down on his bed and turned away his face and would eat no food. Now, has anybody ever seen a grown man behave this way? Yes. You say, yeah, it's not pretty, is it? No, it's bad enough when little children do this, and you know, faithful parents are going to try to teach their children this is not how you behave, because it looks a little more ridiculous on a grown man. And it has a lot greater impact on a grown man. He goes in, he lays down on his bed, he refuses to eat, he refuses to do anything he's supposed to be doing, he just stares and faces the wall. And that's how upset he is. Well, verse 5, enter his faithful wife Jezebel. Let's see how she handles this situation. Jezebel, his wife, came to him and said to him, "Why is your spirit so vexed that you eat no food?" So probably she's noticing that the servants are carrying food back from his room that hasn't been eaten. And so this has been going on for a little while. This isn't like Ahab missed one meal. This is like Ahab has been missing several days and is not eating. Now, understand typically, too, that the king of Israel and his queen probably did not inhabit the same palace or the same rooms. She would have had her own wing where she stayed. And if he wanted her, they would come together. But other than that, she stayed on her end of the house, he stayed on his end of the house, but she's happened to be passing through the royal palace that day, and she notices the stack of, what do you call it, when you get food in your room at the hotel? I forgot the word. What's that? No, I'm thinking room service. She notices the stack of room service trays. Boy, I'm only 40 and my mind is going, right? Right? Right?
It's less arguments.
Yeah. So, I can just imagine how hard it's going to be for me to come up with words when Joshua's here and we're going to be up all night with him, right? And, whew. Might make for some interesting Skip Sunday night. Yeah, right. So anyway, she comes by. She notices this stack of uneaten room service trays there. So she goes into the room and she says, "What is the matter with you?" Now, probably knowing Jezebel, do you think this is tender concern for her husband? No, probably not. This is not a, "What's the matter, dear? What's going on here?" This is more like, "What is with you? What's your problem? Why is your spirit so vexed that you eat no food?" And he said to her, "Because I spoke to Naboth the Jezreelite, and I said to him, 'Give me your vineyard for money, or else if you please, I'll give you another vineyard for it.' And he answered, 'I will not give you my vineyard.'" I'm reading in tone, by the way, right? So he says, "I will not give you my vineyard." Now, pause there. Don't read ahead. How do you think Jezebel's going to handle this? Now, I know most of you know this account anyway. Abby? Oh, she gets other guys to kill Naboth. You're right. You've read this before. Okay. Most of us probably have been familiar with this passage. It's one of the classic ones. But yes, she says, and I love her answer here, not in a great way, right? I love it for what it reveals about her character. What does she say to him in verse 7? The first thing she says, "Do you not now govern Israel?" What is that question communicating? You can do whatever you want. You're the king of Israel. Now, who is Jezebel? Where does she come from? Is she Israelitish? No, she was Phoenician. Yeah, she's one of the Canaanites. Tyre and Phoenicia are up here in the north, Sidon. This is the Phoenician area, Tyre and Sidon up here. And she was a Sidonian princess. Her father gained the crown by killing off the current king. He was the high priest. And he killed off the king and took the crown and eliminated any claimants to the throne. And so that's where Jezebel comes onto the scene. And so Ahab marries her in order to form a political union between Israel and Tyre and Sidon and that area. So he marries the princess Jezebel. This is where she comes from. This is what her parenting has been like. So you can imagine her response. She just figures, "You're the king. You can do whatever you want. Why are you so upset about this? Do something about it." And of course, what she's going to choose to do about it is what Abby said. She's going to have Naboth killed off. And this is her advice as she goes into this. "Arise, eat bread, let your heart be cheerful, and I will give you the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite. I'll convince him to sell." Right? Well, she's not going to convince him to sell. It's a sad thing that so often people in government, any government, this has been true throughout the history of the world, it is not new to this day and age that governments are overbearing and too big and that the people in them have no concern for the people whom they rule. That's pretty much the norm. We've been blessed in America because we very frequently have people who actually consider themselves servants of the public. But understand, that's an odd thing, to have politicians that consider themselves public servants. Not just call themselves public servants, but actually consider themselves public servants. That's an unusual thing in the history of the world. And so Jezebel brings all of the ungodly thinking to government. "Do you not now govern Israel? Do whatever you want. Who's going to stop you? There's no such thing as balance of powers in this kingdom. You are the king. You are the Supreme Court and you're the legislature. Nobody's going to stop you from taking that piece of property." It is the height of tyranny, what she's going to propose here. So, verse 8, "She wrote letters in Ahab's name and sealed them with his seal. And she sent the letters to the elders and the leaders who lived with Naboth in his city. And she wrote in the letters, 'Proclaim a fast and set Naboth at the head of the people. And set two worthless men opposite him and let them bring a charge against him, saying, You have cursed God and the king. Then take him out and stone him to death.'" So here's the process. Here's what I find horribly humorous in a really scary way about this. Why does she bother to go through the whole charade? Okay, so I'm going to set false accusations against Naboth. And we're going to have him executed for that. That's plain as day. The whole plot is to kill Naboth. Why bother going through the motions of a trial? So it won't look like he's been murdered. You're willing to murder somebody, but you're not willing to break the law, so to speak, in order to get the guy killed. Why? Why not just have him killed? If you really think you rule without restraint, why not just have the guy killed? Yeah, maybe you think other people would rise up against that. Yeah. So it is a funny thing that often tyrants try to seemingly obey the law in order to skirt the law. It's a crazy, crazy thing, but you see it happen all the time with tyrannical governments. And the core of it is that tyrants think they are accountable to no one. They think they have zero accountability. They think they don't have to answer to anybody, including God. Find a person who thinks he has to answer to God when this life is over, even if it's a bad doctrinal thing, and you'll find somebody that's going to be a lot more controlled in how they administer a governmental position. Right? Well, Jezebel's got no fear of God or of men, so she here's her plan. We're going to set a fast, a feast, really, and because you would fast during the day, and then you'd have a big feast at the end of it. And so we're going to set this up, and we're going to have Naboth as the man of honor, and at the end of it all, two guys are going to accuse him. Why two guys? You got to have two witnesses. So here again, you see her trying to keep the semblance of the law while violating the very core of the law. So we're going to set up two witnesses to falsely accuse Naboth. And what are the charges? He dishonored God and the king. What does that actually mean? Probably means about the same thing as an obstruction of justice charge, right? I know, that's a horribly political statement to make right now, but it's nebulous, it's vague. Can you disprove it? You can't prove it either. But how do you disprove it? Well, I don't know. Did he ever say anything that was even critical of the king? Maybe he did. If Naboth is a faithful man, you think at some point in his life he criticized Ahab for the way he was governing? It's possible. And so here this is going to come out, and they're going to kill him for it. They're going to stone him for this stuff. But the charge is nebulous. The charge doesn't make sense. The charge doesn't actually state anything specific. But this is how they're going to skirt around the law. You cursed God and the king. Now, you have two witnesses. How is the trial supposed to go according to Mosaic law? The elders are supposed to set those two witnesses down and cross-examine them. Question them thoroughly, seriously, deeply. Look into their accusations and see if they agree point for point. What did he say? What were the words that he used? What time of day was it? Where'd you hear him? What was he wearing? What kind of tone did he use? Because you want to make sure that these two witnesses actually agree, because you're supposed to be looking into whether or not they are true witnesses or false witnesses. Now, if they're true witnesses and the crime actually does violate one of God's standards, what should happen? Then Naboth would be executed. What if it's found out that the witnesses are lying? They get executed. They're supposed to have done to them what they wanted to have done to the other person. Boy, wouldn't that cut down some of our court cases? You know, if you try to sue somebody for whatever perceived slight and you're proven wrong, you actually are the one that has to pay the fine. Well, that'd cut down on a few of our nebulous lawsuits, wouldn't it? Well, obviously, though, Israel is not implementing the Mosaic standards of the law at this period. And so the trial goes. There's not probably a whole lot of questioning because Naboth is convicted. And all of this happens and Naboth is killed. So verse 11 is where we get the actual happening of it. The men of his city, the elders and the leaders who lived in his city, did as Jezebel had sent word to them. as it was written in the letters that she had sent to them. They proclaimed a fast, set Naboth at the head of the people, and the two worthless men came in, sat opposite him, and the worthless men brought a charge against Naboth in the presence of the people, saying, Naboth cursed God and the king. So they took him outside the city, and they stoned him to death with stones. Then they sent to Jezebel, saying, Naboth has been stoned, he is dead. And as soon as Jezebel heard that Naboth had been stoned and was dead, Jezebel sent to Ahab, Arise, take possession of the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite, which he refused to give you for money, for Naboth is not alive but dead. And as soon as Ahab heard that Naboth was dead, he arose to go down to the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite to take possession of it. So what cures his pout? He got what he wanted. And how did he get it? Deceit and murder. So let's think about this. Is Ahab guilty of murder?
No.
Guilt by association? Mm-hmm. As a co-conspirator. Yes, I think you can absolutely say yes, Ahab is guilty of murdering Naboth. Any chance he didn't know what was going on?
Probably not.
He probably knew what Jezebel was going to do to him, right? He knew his wife well enough to know that, but he didn't stop it. And once it happens, does he take her into custody and say, oh, you wicked woman, you deserve to die? I mean, would you want to try that? Well, Ahab takes possession of the vineyard. We'll have to finish up next week, I guess. We're getting close to our time here. So in the next few verses, we're going to see God's response to all of this. So, any questions about anything that's going on here?